Welcome back to The Competitors. My name is Bob Babbitt, and his name is Paul Hullin. We're brought to you every Sunday night by Rubio's Jamba Juice, CompetitorRadio.com, and MuddyBuddy.com. Hope everybody had a great training and racing weekend. We are joined, Huddle.
Yes.
A living legend.
Love this guy.
First American winner of the Tour de France.
That's right.
World champion, three-time Tour de France champion, one of the most influential cyclists in history, the first guy to ride the clipless pedals, the aero bars,
I think the first
helmet.
Cyclist to get on the cover of SI,
a
too.
First, yeah, absolutely. Yes, the first guy, Sportsman of the Year, all the rest. Mr. Greg LeMond joins us from his mansion somewhere deep in Minnesota. How you doing, Greggy?
The mansion is somewhere in Minnesota. I live in, I'm in western Minneapolis. I'm good, Paul and Bob. I'm doing great.
Awesome, awesome. Hey, Greg, what I'd like to do, first of all, is Huddle and I are such good, we're so such geeks on the history of cycling and just some
sick.
Of the stuff you've done, I know, is wanted to go back a little bit to really when you first got, I mean, when you got into cycling, it really wasn't what you'd consider a mainstream sport in this country at all. How did you discover it, and when did you realize that you had a talent to be good at it?
Well, I got into cycling, and, well, I started riding my bike in 75, the recommendation of a coach at a ski camp. I was a downhill skier,
yeah.
Wanted to be a freestyle skier. So I started riding my bikes in 75. As I repeat the story, there was no snow in the Sierras, and my dad and I started riding together. And I started riding in 1976 in my first race was in Sacramento. And grew up racing in Northern California, raced in Southern California a couple times, quite a few times.
Yeah.
But back in the 70s, believe it or not, I think there were more juniors than there are today. And I think there's probably just so many more other sports athletes have a choice of doing. But it was an underground sport, but there were almost 30,000 registered members. Today there's 55, but in the junior level, I'd show up at Northern California races with 80 to 100 racers.
That's
wow.
Amazing.
And so it was it's part of that's what fascinated me was I didn't even know the sport existed. And I met somebody in Reno, a guy named Roland Elisana, who makes custom bikes. And he had 20 years worth of French magazines of the Tour de France. And just kind of discovering that part of that this is a big sport and nobody knows about it. And I happen to be good at it. I won my first 11 races.
You won your first 11 races.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, and then I kept asking permission to race in different age categories and kept winning those races. And so I happened to find something I was really good at it, and a 14-year-old kid that, you know, never thought of anything competitively. I was really a skier, and if you think of freestyle skiing, it's kind of a judged event. I was
right.
into backpacking, fly fishing, hiking. So I wasn't into competitive sports, and so for me it was a big, it was really exciting to get into something that, you know, I think the big part of it was my dad was racing also.
Right.
And it became a family affair, kind of. Every weekend we'd sit out on our Volkswagen Vanagon to somewhere in Northern California, Southern California, race Saturday and Sunday and come home.
That's
so
fun.
It was really fun.
That's great. Hey, Greg, just to give folks some perspective of what it was like racing at that time, can you relate some of the equipment things? Like when you first started racing, I'm assuming you had those basic cycling shoes that you had the toe straps that clipped in. Maybe you didn't.
Yep.
Maybe you had sneakers. But were you wearing helmets? What sorts of things were...
Yeah, the helmets were required. When I started racing, I just restored my first real racing bike, which was a Cinelli, which I thought was the most advanced racing bike at the time. It's actually a piece of art. It's got chrome lugs and all handmade, but it weighs 27 pounds. So it's heavier. It's about 3-4 pounds heavier, 5 pounds heavier than in the top racing mountain bikes. And we had, you know, at the time, Campagnolo was the gear of choice.
Right.
Italian manufacturer. Almost everything came out of Italy that was the top quality stuff. And toe straps and toe clips were standard until about 1985. And even all the way through the late 80s, some riders like Sean Kelly continued to wear toe straps and clips. In fact, I just rode with the mayor Dick
really?
Bearden of Los Angeles.
Yeah.
He pulled out a 20-year-old bike, and he had toe clips on it. I hadn't seen that in 20 years. So, and then the leather shoes, there were these Italian manufacturers that handmade leather soles that were hardened leather, commercial-grade leather that was, and you'd buy your shoes 4 or 5 sizes too small. You'd walk around them for days with alcohol and water soaking them, so they kind of form right to your feet. And I still have that habit of wanting to wear my shoes just like a glove.
Right.
And I've had a lot of foot pain trying to keep with that same feel that I used to have when I just started racing.
Actually, we had Davis Finney on last year, and he was telling us a story about, he says, you know, this is what type of talent Greg LeMond was. Where, you know, he says, me being Davis Finney, of course, I bring three and four of everything. And Greg just sort of throws all the crap into a bag and comes down to Mexico. And, of course, he doesn't have his bike shoes, and I've got, like, three pairs.
That's right. So, he remembers that.
Yeah, and he goes, and not only that, my shoes were, like, four or five sizes too big for him, and he shoves tissue or newspapers or toilet paper in the front of the shoes and just rides away from the field. in my shoes. And it says it's not like the shoes nowadays where it's, you know, you can move the cleat. I mean, basically the cleat fits
with
right
hammered in. On.
Yeah,
right.
It's hammered on. It says that's the type of talent the guy was. He just could take your equipment and beat you, and it didn't matter.
At that time I got more picky as I got into professional racing. Everything became a millimeter here, a millimeter there, but when I was young it was all I thought about was winning. Didn't matter.
So, Greg, when you started, you must have had, what, 10 cogs on that rear cassette, yeah?
Yeah. Well, we had five.
Five.
Yeah, five on the back. And the small – that's what – you know, I've tried to explain how much different climbing was back when I started racing, because really the smallest tooth was on the back cog was a 24 that you can get. And the smallest chain ring was at 42. So when you climb these European passes that had some grades were up to 15, 16% grades, I mean, you had to be so fit to keep the RPMs up.
Right.
Otherwise, your RPMs drop. You're just, you know, you get bogged down. You can't produce a good power output. So today, I mean, I'm totally out of shape. And with a triple chain ring, I could still go climb up to Oz without hardly training and make it up. But back in my days, if you didn't have a level of fitness, you'd have to walk up the climb.
Oh.
I don't know. I think Babbitt would still have to walk up the climb.
I would walk up it anyways.
Well, I figure there's – hey, I'm way fatter than I used to be, way heavier, and I could figure out a gear that can get me up almost any hill.
Hey, Greg, can you talk a little bit about the training back then versus the training now? And in terms of volume, intensity, all of that stuff, I mean, has it really changed that much?
Well, I think that's – part of the sport that I'm really fascinated about, and I've done a tremendous amount of reading, studying. I was kind of my own coach, but I happen to have the influence of several really good coaches, but probably the most influential of the scientific kind of background was a guy named Paul Coakley, who was our coach in 85 and 86 and part of 87 until I got shot and they kicked me off the team. But
until I got shot
and they kicked me off the team. Nice.
The interesting thing, you know, at the time when Paul Coakley, he was had a degree from sports medicine in Switzerland, and at the same time, Conconi was doing the Conconi test.
Right,
and,
yep.
You know, they broke the hour record, and there was some new secret training of the lactate threshold, and, you know, years later, you turn out, you know, it really was blood doping is what Conconi was doing with Francesca Moser. And
right.
There's no doubt that they Conconi focused their training on the event and that specific intensity. But, you know, I don't think, you know, physiology, it's like physics, it doesn't change, although theories might come and go. And I think in world-class sports, I think there's a lot of myths going around that, you know, there's this, you shouldn't train over your lactate threshold. Well, if you're maybe into running or really long-distance triathlon, there's probably not a need, but professional cycling has intensities that go very wide range, and intervals are an integral part. And I believe that there's a point of there's a refocus. If you know, I think in professional cycling, unfortunately, drugs have kind of thrown out the basic physiology. You know, it used to be when you trained 3-4 days, you needed a recovery.
Sure.
But if you're taking hormones to replace, you know, typically when you train very hard, you get cortisol that elevates. Testosterone starts to drop, and after about 3-4 days, your body's telling you, okay, recover. You take a couple days off, you start a new training cycle. And that hasn't changed. The thing that's changed is that some people are cheating and using stuff to help recover much faster, so they're able to possibly achieve a higher level quicker. But the big thing, the big gain in I think, world-class sports has been the addition of blood doping techniques, such as EPO, blood transfusions. There's a bovine hemoglobin called HemoPure that can add up to 40% oxygen carrying capacity.
Yeah.
So that kind of throws, you know, so many things out of whack. And there's a perception, oh, there's better training today. That's why they're faster. And, you know, the truth is the evolution of the human bodies hasn't changed over thousands of years, although I do believe absolutely in evolution. I don't believe that in 10 years, all of a sudden athletes just evolved to be that much genetically better. So the only thing that would explain it would be equipment, which
hasn't changed that much.
It doesn't change that much. There's been a lot of studies in Europe on the climbs and the Tour de France, and they've got records going back 25 years, and it's almost a 25% jump in power output from the late 80s, early 90s until, you know, the recent Tour de France's. So there's no logical explanation for that type of jump except for a potential doping.
Greg, in your day, in your era, in the mid-80s, when you're racing the Tour de France and going through your training cycles, what markers were you looking at on a year-round basis to determine your fitness? Was it simply how well you felt on different training rides? Were you using a heart rate monitor? Were you blood tests, nutrition?
Yeah, I was, you know, obviously we did some VO2 max testing, but, you know, it's kind of always been a joke. My first VO2 max was at the Olympic Training Center in 1977 on a treadmill, and at the time I had one of the highest VO2 maxes, but, you know, I was on a treadmill. I'm a cyclist. Didn't make much sense.
Yeah.
But we always did these tests, but nobody gave us any reason for taking them. All they did is, it was like we were rats on a big science lab.
Right.
Nobody said, okay, here's your VO2 max, here's a period that you should, this is your weakness, this is what you need to train on. So by 1984, 85, I started using a heart rate monitor. But even then, that is, you know, it allowed you to have a measurable, okay, I'm going to go at this certain level. And at that time there was the talk of, you know, 220 minus
your age
was your max heart rate,
right,
which is totally disproven. Yeah. I think it was two cardiologists on a plane that just decided we need a protocol.
Right.
Let's just come up with a number. 220 minus your age.
Yeah.
So it had no scientific basis, and then there was this perceived idea that a lactate threshold was a percentage of your max heart rate, which is still not true, because certain people, the lactate threshold thing has been debated for years. Certain people can tolerate 3 millimoles of lactate. Some people can ride for an hour up to with 6 millimoles of lactate. So it's been, you know, now we're learning that, you know, your body actually metabolizes and uses lactate for energy. And so this whole idea of never going over your lactate threshold is also kind of getting thrown out the window, which it rightfully should be. I think there's been a lot of murky, mythical reasons why people have just all of a sudden improved, better training techniques. And what I was saying is the truth is I've won the Tour de France where I've had everything just perfectly dialed down, where I was absolutely dialed down to my 86 Tour de France, where I really was at my best. Then 89, I barely got in shape for it. Almost quit cycling 8 weeks before.
Right.
I still won the tour. And then 1990, I had mono. And I barely started training in May, although I trained in a very, always under my limit. I made a huge amount of progress in 2 months. But I won the Tour de France really not even close to my maximum capabilities. But I got close. And I think that, you know, the truth is I've seen athletes who train totally improperly and win races, and some people train perfectly properly. And a lot of perception, I think, is, you know, there's some kind of, I don't know what they call it, it would be like an anorexia-type mentality of a lot of endurance athletes. They just believe more is better.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
And they've proven that chronic overtraining can actually decrease performance way more than undertraining. So you're always better to err on the slightly undertrained than the overtrained. You could drop performance by 20-25% being chronically overtrained. And the dangerous thing with endurance sports is if you do lots and lots of volume, that's why I believe in doing quality first and then your volume after. If you haven't recovered, it's very difficult to do the high quality stuff. But you could always go out and do hours and hours on your bike.
Sure.
And slowly you build your testosterone drops, you get your immune system kind of flattens out, and you be susceptible to a lot of viruses and colds. And so it's you know, crucial to kind of know how to monitor your recovery.
Right. Were you looking at blood tests at that time? Were you looking at,
No.
I'm assuming you would look maybe at iron levels or things like that. I mean, it sounds like you didn't look at that until 89, but in the
I didn't see that. You know, it is a major, you know, one of my major weaknesses, not weakness, I think it was one of my reasons I never, you know, it's kind of like I didn't see drug taking in the 80s because it's kind of like, you know, if you're a heroin addict, you know, a lot of people take heroin or I just didn't want to even go to, you know, for me, taking a needle or a shot or anything was just a road I didn't want to go down. And when I got shot in 87, you know, although I lost 70% of my blood volume, I lost 30 pounds of muscle mass. I went down to 121 pounds. In the 2 years of trying to come back, I never did a blood test, and I had zero iron stores. And the first blood test was during the Giro d'Italia in 1989. And my first vitamin shot was an iron shot, and I did three of them. And I believe either it was a placebo effect, but I think it actually, to bind oxygen to hemoglobin, you have to have iron. And I think there was a real physiological help with me in it. But and I started watching my VO2 max and doing more blood work on my at least on my iron stores after that. But that was the last time I just took a multivitamin from that point on with iron.
Sort of like what the other guys do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah. You know what? You know, talk a little bit about that. Babbitt and I were talking about this. I mean, we've been talking about this, I think, for the last month. You
carbon
know,
isotope,
in light
baby.
Of, yeah, in light of everything that's happened. But where the only place that we can find to draw a line is simply in, is something legal or is it illegal? Because when you look at 89, just like you said, you had three iron shots that brought you around, and I don't think anyone would say, oh, that's illegal, because, you know, look at what happened to you, look at where you were, and that's something that anybody would do.
Well, actually, I think if EPO was available in 1987,
yeah,
I didn't have a blood transfusion, which my hematocrit dropped to 19%.
Oh.
And so the only reason I didn't have a blood transfusion is that the blood bank at UC Davis had multiple cases of AIDS, HIV contamination. So the doctor, trauma surgeon, knew I was a world-class athlete, so they thought my blood volume would be higher. But it really hindered my recovery. I mean, I think had I been able to get a blood transfusion or had EPO administered, it would have been sped my recovery dramatically. But the truth is, I mean, it's very clear, it's very well written in the UCI code of ethics and doping and WADA. Vitamins are something that are, you know, if your diet's improper, some people have a hard time absorbing iron. Same with B12, and those are not considered illegal, but any hormonal blood-enhancing product is absolutely illegal, and it's considered cheating.
Right,
and
right.
So there's a pretty – every athlete in cycling or world-class sports knows exactly what's legal and isn't. And I really do have a hard time with part of the problem with cycling is that there's doctors that tell the riders that pathology-wise your hormone's low and you need to take this. And there's talk about revising the length of the Tour de France and the distances. And, you know, the truth is doping would make a difference if it's a one-day event or a three-week event. The secret is protecting those that don't want to take anything, because the truth is the side effects of any drug you don't know, and the long-term health side, you just have no clue. And there's a lot of evidence that extreme endurance athletes, even without drugs, is not healthy, but that doesn't justify the means of enhancing an athlete's hormonal level. Now, if they're chronically ill and fatigued and all that, obviously, in a medical term, if they're not competing, they might be able to be helped medically, but that would be up to a doctor. And I think there's a code of ethics that medical doctors usually follow, but that it's not followed by everybody.
Greg, in 89 you win, 1990 you win, your team wins the team classification, I think, in 90. In something we chatted about before, by 92 or so, your team really wasn't competitive anymore. At that point, did it become crystal clear to you that there was something going on beyond what you thought was happening? And
no, it didn't become crystal clear till 93, and that was what was so devastating for a lot of riders in the early 90s, is that, you know, the winner of the Tour de France at that point claimed weight loss was why he just all of a sudden started going from, you know, not competitive in the Tour de France and winning 5 years in a row.
Right.
And it fed everybody this self-doubt. I mean, for me, I showed up in 91 significantly better training than 1990, and I took the yellow jersey the first day. I told my wife, who's here? There's no competitors. Fignon wasn't competitive. Kiyopuchi, I didn't take as a real threat. I won by, you know, a couple minutes the year before, and he had a 10-minute lead, and so I'm like, God, this is going to be an easy race. And it was literally my only gauge of my performance that I used at that time was my Vespa up in Belgium. You'd train on canals.
Sure.
And prior to the 89 and 90 tour, the week before, I was motor pacing on for about 2 hours of probably an hour and a half of continuous output of around 80 kilometers an hour, which is 50 miles an hour.
Ooh,
wow.
And I was just flying. Now, those are the 2 years I won. 91, I was doing 85 kilometers an hour. I was as well prepared as I ever was for the Tour de France, similar to what I was in 1986. And by the first time trial, I think I'm flying, and I lose by 8 seconds to Miguel Indurain. And
right.
3 days later, we have a stage. Now, I've been racing for 10 years at this point. We have a stage that's 148 miles long. We stop three times for a train. We averaged 31 miles an hour.
Oh.
And it was like, it was just black and white, like it was, something was going on. Now, I just thought I was getting worse.
Right.
I just thought maybe I wasn't trained as well as I thought. You know,
sure.
All of a sudden, all the self-doubt, the psychological. Athletes, usually most athletes don't look for excuse until there's black and white. You always look inward and say, God, I need to train better. Maybe I've got, you know, 1/10 of a pound too much fat on me. That's why I'm not feeling good. I mean, I went through that whole thing for a couple of years until 93, and we found out from another rider on the ONCE team what was going on. And it was EPO, growth hormone, testosterone, and it was Spanish and Italian riders that were the leaders. And at that time, several doctors were training up to 40, 50 riders, and they just dominated every event that they went into. And the French riders basically fell off the face of the earth.
They really did.
And until 95, when Festina finally said, well, we're going to do the
method
that everybody else is doing, all of a sudden they dominate until 98. I mean, they're very competitive, at least, not
right.
dominate.
They didn't dominate.
Yeah, they're very competitive, and 98 happens. And since then, the French have just kind of, you know, faded away in the background.
Greg, anytime a champion, a past champion, comes forward and is talking about a current champion, and I'll relate like the 72 Dolphins. I can relate Dave Scott when I've heard him commentate about the Ironman, and then you talk to some of the guys about some of his comments, and they get very angry about it. Anytime a past champion says anything about current status, it all gets attributed to sour grapes.
Yeah.
I don't agree with that, and I just wonder, how do you defend yourself against that? You know, when you're just making comments basically from a point of knowledge, from someone who's been there and experienced the transition, and then now you're getting told, oh, it's just sour grapes.
Well, it's, you know, it's been particularly difficult for me because of an American's been winning the Tour the last 7 years. But if you go back in 98, I was in France at the Tour de France with the Festina, and I am in papers and being interviewed saying this is the best thing
right
to happen to cycling, and this is what it needs. This is a major problem. And my issues go back way to what we just described. I watched a teammate of mine in 93. We found out what the riders were doing, and I watched the psychological pressure from the team managers telling the riders either they perform or they're fired or their pay is dropped. And the one rider on the team went up in front of the whole team, said, yeah, this is what's going on. Either you provide the same or you lay off. And and Roger Leger said, I can't do that ethically. This rider left to an Italian team, Mercatoni Uno. I saw him the month before I stopped. He told me exactly what was going on, EPO, growth hormone, testosterone. And then 8 months later, he died of a heart attack.
Wow.
And so this is where I'm coming from. And then I watched the Festina affair. I watched this continuous ignoring the head in the sand deal. And I've just been, it's been kind of like a volcano that's kind of simmering, waiting to erupt. And I think that the sport needs exactly what's happening right now. I love the sport. And I have been way too much knowledge of what's going on in the sport, and it's been very difficult for me. And I just, you know, in the long term, I think the truth comes out, and, you know, I've taken a lot of abuse and a lot of, you know, this is a sport where silence is the given
right
manner, and anybody who wants to be honest about it is the black sheep, and they're spitting in the soup, and they get blackballed from the sport. And fortunately, my life isn't dependent on cycling. It's a sport I love. You know, I've had some difficult times in the past with another rider, but it's, you know, I prefer not to mention his name, but I'm just fortunate I was able to race in my period that I did. And the only thing I would like is, my hope is that the sport and all sports, because it's a very short-sighted view to think, well, there's talk of, well, just legalize it. Well, imagine you're a father or mother that at least has a level head and just decides, you know, I love my kids, I'm going to protect them. If there's if there's a lot of sick parents out there, I mean,
right, no
obviously
question.
You could look at a lot of parents that are parents of athletes. They would do anything for their kids to success. But the majority of parents, I think, have a very level-headed mind and care about their kids. But if the sport has a drug culture, who's going to participate in that? Long-term, it's a disease that is, people say, well, they're adults. You can let them take what they want. Well, those adults that are cyclists became cyclists when they were kids. And they get into it, they love it, and they have to be faced with that difficult decision in their 20s. And you could maybe argue that, well, they're adults, they can decide what they want. But and if that's the way it is, it has to be very transparent so parents will know, with a base of knowledge, what their kids are getting into.
Yeah, Greg, one of the things that we chatted about yesterday was, you know, when you were a junior racing over in Belgium, you could look through the paper any weekend and find, you know, 10, 15, 20 events, and 150 cyclists would be there. And it just, it seems like your concern, because you do love the sport, you grew up with the sport in a what we would consider as a more pure era, that you would like to see it like that again, that it's that a lot of people are moving away from the sport. I mean, we're seeing it with, in this country, there's a boom, more people are riding probably than ever before, but the impression I got from you from when you go to Europe, there's less people riding, and maybe it's because of all this, you know, it looks like a pharmaceutical convention rather than a bike race.
And I think, you know, interestingly, I think that the participation, there's a great thing about cycling, it is a great sport for
right
fitness. People love it. I think, you know, I've done enough charity events to see the good that cycling does, and
absolutely
the social bonding that it helps people get. And in that part, I think it's, the sport's very healthy, but a lot of people get inspired by racing, and if there's continuous scandals, it definitely will affect it long term. And I think that it is proof, and I told you, Bob, that in Saint-Brieuc, the town in Nantes, Brittany, France, where Bernard Hinault was from, in 1980 when he won the second tour, there were 220 licensed racers. Today, Velo magazine did a survey. There were six racers.
Six.
Oof. Six.
Yeah.
So 220 to six. Now, that is really across the board in Italy. The only country I've heard hasn't been as affected as much as Belgium. Because Belgium is deeply rooted in cycling. I mean, it is,
right,
it's truly the heart of cycling. But, you know, that's, you know, the one thing I have to say about cycling relative to a lot of other professional sports and in its defense is that it's good, you know, the positive thing you get when there are drug tests is you catch people. And you catch people and it causes an uproar, and it does hurt sometimes the pain, and but at least they're doing it. There's a lot of professional sports out there that are, you know, if they had the same strict drug test at cycling, there would be you know, scandals every day in the paper. The only thing as I have to say is that it still doesn't matter what the other sports does or do to combat doping. I still, you can never do enough. And that's my critique is that, you know, yeah, the UCI has done a great deal, but it's obvious by the recent scandals they haven't done enough.
Somehow, Greg, it seems like in the other sports that you're talking about, and I can mention baseball, football, basketball, the testing that's there, baseball is starting to get some testing, but it almost seems like when someone is implicated in doping in those sports, it's okay. Whereas in cycling and track and field and sports like that, you know, people are pretty much criminals. And so when you look at it, if I'm a parent and my kid's getting involved in sports, I got no problem with soccer. I've got no problem with baseball. I've got no problem with these other sports. But as soon as I hear cycling, I'm wondering how many parents now, and you talked about the involvement of kids in youth cycling now in the junior programs. Do you think this is part of the problem? And is the dope testing that's going on now and what cycling's going through now going to finally get it to come around, or is it just hurting the whole process?
No, I don't think you have a choice. Either you capitulate and say it's an open free for all,
right?
Which
yeah.
I think would hurt the sport just as well.
Sure.
And or you say, okay, I don't think there's been enough. There has not been a crisis big enough for the sport of cycling to really, really pay attention. I think the combination of Operation Puerto, where they took second, third, fourth, and fifth out of this year's Tour de France, and then you have the Tour de France winner being positive, I think finally there's a financial cost to the sport. Up until now, there's been no financial fallout. So money's driving is a driving force, and I think the difference between American sports and running, track and field, triathlons, cross-country skiing, there's the participants who do it for their own self-health and benefit. And they do it out of more of a purity, kind of an Olympic spirit. This is me, and this is my deal. If I cheated to win races, the only person, I'd be defrauding the public, I'd be defrauding sponsors, but more importantly, I'd be defrauding myself. And I think that's the difference between, you know, football. I don't think anybody pretends this, that sport is, football is clean. I mean,
just look at them.
There's more 300-pound guys in there. And I think, you know, I think that cycling, it's so emotional, and because it is, you build these heroes up, you look at them, you want to believe in them, and it's like getting punched in the stomach when somebody gets positive. And then that's where the anger comes even greater, because there's so much emotional investment into those athletes following them that the denial system is so incredible in endurance sports, I believe, that they don't look at the real reality, the proof that's out there, and actually have a skeptical eye. So they bought into it, they're believers, and then, boom, somebody's caught. It's just so devastating. But you're right. I don't think Floyd is, Floyd Landis is going to take, you know, he's going to be kind of like Ben Johnson, where you got Barry Bonds is out there. A lot of these baseball players, I mean, they're just as popular as ever. And the question is, you know, I am shocked that people don't care, but I also look at that as a devaluing our social ethics. I mean, I was at a writers' conference over the week, and they talked about baseball players getting inducted into the Hall of Fame. They said, well, does, you know, the writer just said, well, you know, somebody asked a question, does it matter? And the writer was actually, it does, but we have to look at it in a big concept. One guy said, well, I don't think it matters. And I'm thinking, all these guys are novelists, journalists, I said, well, if somebody plagiarized your book, would it matter?
And won an award of some sort.
Yeah, and won an award. I mean, you know, it comes down to, you know, is cheating on your taxes okay? Is, you know, recreational drug use is a different animal. I think addiction's a different animal. That's, you know, really they're hurting their own person. They're not, you know, unless they're drinking and driving or taking drugs and driving, those are personal things, but when you're actually participating in doping, you're cheating a lot of people out of their – you're cheating the innocent person who doesn't want to do it.
And you know what's interesting, Greg? I was just talking with Ned Overend yesterday, and he did this Mount Washington Hill climb back east against Tyler Hamilton. And Ned's comment after finishing second to Tyler says, you know, it didn't seem like Tyler was happy in his own skin. You could just tell that, you know, there's a guilt there. that it just makes it hard for these guys to live with themselves.
Yeah, I think that's the – nobody sees a tragedy of, you know, a lot of these athletes. I mean, if you go back to 1996, and I remember this, I was a color commentator at the Olympics, and there was a survey done amongst Olympic athletes, and they were asked if they were, you know, if they could win a gold medal, but they have to take a pill that would kill them in 10 years, like 55% or something absurd like that, said they would do it.
Right.
And so in the short term, people are looking at the success, fame, money. Long term, what cheating does is decay the whole psychological part of a human, and they pay the people, unless you're a sociopath, people have a conscience, will pay a huge price, and it won't be 5 years. It'll be 10, 15, 20 years down the road. And unfortunately, for Tyler, he's, there's so much evidence that's backed up the original test that he's a guy that, you know, I wish the way he's going to have to live with himself is to kind of just come clean on it. And I think people have forgiveness and an ability to respect somebody. It's their shame is so powerful to come clean on certain things that it becomes almost, you know, impossible for somebody to come clean. But once they do that, it can, you know, help save their life.
Greg, after looking at the history of that whole thing with Tyler and realizing that, wow, he's guilty, and having, you know, your heart ripped out about that, because, you know, after watching the broken collarbone, the dog, all that, and then going, wow, he's just like all of them. And then having what's happened with Floyd, like you said, everyone got punched in the stomach. But playing devil's advocate, what if Floyd truly, just like he said, didn't take anything knowingly? He obviously had something in his blood. He had the testosterone there. But what if he is telling the truth? What if he said, look, you know, as far as I know, I was the strongest guy. I won the race. I deserved it. What do you say to that? I mean, is a possibility.
Obviously, I mean, that's what his attorneys will have to look for, but and that's why they'll, you know, test the validity of the test. Unfortunately, I think that his chances of getting off are going to be pretty slim. Part of it is the denial of everybody else in the past, and, you know, there's a lot coming out linking different athletes to certain doctors, and, you know, I feel the same way about Floyd. I'd watched him. I was convinced that this was one of the cleaner tours. The power outputs were lower.
You got sucked in like we did, huh?
I did, and
I
like Floyd.
Floyd
is a perfect reason, and Tyler, of what's wrong is you take good people and you don't give them a choice, and that's what's wrong with doping, is that I believe that the majority of the riders in the Tour de France don't want to take drugs, but if the system's broken and right. They don't feel like it's a level playing field, they just feel like they got to keep up.
Right.
Now, as far as Floyd being totally innocent, I can't ever make a judgment on that. And unfortunately for him, he'll have to prove
that
somehow there was
sabotage
or something like that, which is going to be very difficult to do. And it's going to be a difficult battle for him.
And that's actually an issue that we have to deal with, not only with the Tour, but with Ironman and events like that, because you're competing on an open road. At least in the Tour de France, you're just getting stuff from your own team, and you're hoping your own team isn't sabotaging you.
But that's always a risk. But I think at a professional level, you know, you've always are aware of it. And unfortunately, this isn't to convict at all Floyd, but testosterone and all the recent drug investigations, testosterone is kind of like the foundation of most doping programs. It's kind of, I think, the minimum riders would do, and that doesn't mean, I'm not saying Floyd did it at all.
Right.
I'm just saying that the odds against him and the evidence against him are the public perception of what's going on in cycling in Europe and with the governing bodies and the Tour de France. They're not going to give Floyd too much benefit of the doubt.
No. Any, have you had any conversations with him?
In
what rec, if you haven't, what?
I really, you know, I haven't. I don't. I have had a conversation. I really don't want to discuss it.
Yeah,
it was really a friendly talk.
Gotcha.
It was nothing. You know, I think we both just talked about the state of the sport, and you know, nothing more than that.
Greg, with regard to Operation Puerto, and I think just looking back at doping generally over the years, and I think Jacques Anquetil was quoted as saying, you know, you can't win the Tour just on mineral water. How deep does the infrastructure go? I mean, I think when after the wall came down, we saw what was going on in East Germany, that this wasn't just coaches and athletes. This was actually a state-sponsored system. Could it go as deeply as the corporate backing? I mean, the actual sponsors. I mean, I think of a situation like Floyd, and I think if I'm Phonak and I've had all this going down, and you know, we just need something, and he just got slaughtered the day before. You know what? Maybe without him knowing, if I can just get something into him,
I don't think it's the corporate, but it's the there is a system of the coaches. You got to look at these individual teams are owned by ex bike racers.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
They basically own the team. They go out and get a sponsor for 10 million euros, which is about $12 million, and they run a budget. And if you own the team, you could probably make a million or two a year. So the incentive to have the team perform and continue to attract the sponsors is incredible. I don't believe any of the sponsors are doing that type of pressure at all. It's coming within this team infrastructure. They're actually kind of independent contractors contract out to get sponsors. But the pressure for the money is influencing the pressure from the coach to have the rider perform. And I do believe, like, the future has to be dealt with. If, say, Floyd's positive, I believe, like, there needs to be a plea bargain type deal. Either he's banned for life, none of this 2 years, but banned for life, or he comes clean and helps take the system and incentive out of the program. If he could do that, imagine if Floyd, if he is in fact positive and was guilty, and I'm not saying he is,
right?
But he, you know, he told who the doctor was their organization, the team, and if that proves to be the case, they're immediately banned from the sport for life. That's the coach. All of a sudden, you take all the financial incentive out, at least part of it.
Sure.
There's always going to be somebody who thinks they can get away with it. But if you can, and I think this is the tipping point. I think there's a big shift in the UCI, a big shift in the even the riders. They realize, oh my gosh, we're killing our sport.
Right. Yeah.
People have talked about the fact that the lab, L'Equipe, and the organization itself of the Tour de France is owned by the same parent company. Do you think, I mean, this sounds like a complete conspiracy theory. What do you think about that?
Absolutely not. Yeah. I've raced for 14 years in Europe. I cannot for the life of me fathom why the Tour de France would want to discredit. They just lost their major car sponsor. I mean, they have every incentive. In fact, I've always been critical that is the truth really coming out about the sport, because the financial incentives to keep it from coming out
are
so great. And I think, you know, the what you're talking about, and I don't want to mention names, but that was just investigative reporting at its best. And I think there's going to be a lot of, there's this somehow this anti, you know, obviously there's a little bit of anti-Americanism in Europe, not because of sports. I think for any athlete to make a claim that they're as important as the Iraq War is they're a little full of themselves. I think that the fact is that, you know, there's been some real hardline investigative reporters that have been investigating this sport, and rightfully so. And that's really where it came. And the UCI and the WADA and that would not use a lab that was corrupt,
right? Yeah.
and would not keep, you know, using the same lab.
Right.
And if you look at the logic, I mean, Roberto Heras was busted in Spain. They're taking out their own people.
They are. Yeah.
So it's not just, we got to fight these Americans. I mean, the fact is, the sad part is, in the reality is that Americans cheat just like every other country, and we're not above it.
Not the USA.
the other side is. I mean,
I know it's like if you question Bush's Iraq war tactics, that you're anti-American,
right.
And if you question American athletes, you're anti-American. Which is, you know, to me, I'm just looking at. I want a level playing field. I think Andy Hampson wrote a great letter about 2 years ago in my defense, but it's like we want the same opportunity that Andy Hampson and I had going into cycling. I want to be able to go up and have a 17-year-old kid go to Europe and race and not be faced with, do I capitulate and cross the line?
Right.
that should never be, that should never have to be a choice of a young adult pursuing a career in something that he loves.
You know, and Greg, the other side of that is from an American perspective, Greg LeMond becoming the first American to win the Tour de France, all of a sudden the Tour became visible in the United States, which meant that CBS paid rights fees to come over there and cover the thing. And they certainly have benefited from the years of Lance as a, winning the Tour, with Nike getting involved, and OLN. And so from a financial perspective, no one's out to get the Americans.
No, it's just a simmering problem that's just been there. That, you know, that's, I've argued with many people within the industry,
sure,
that, you know, it's not my, you know, for some reason in today's world they love to shoot the messenger instead of listening to the messenger and just, right, saying, okay, how do we solve this problem? And you know, a lot of the messengers that are saying this, they get just immediately pounced upon. And but the problem isn't going away. It's not me by speaking out against drugs that's causing this bad publicity for cycling. It's those who choose to cheat,
right,
and take drugs, and that's what's causing the damage.
Hey, Greg, in the same vein of people, of being shocked that people don't seem to care, for example, with some of the scandal in baseball, et cetera, do you think that the Europeans have a different view or a different tolerance for the scandal that goes on? And using the example of Richard Virenque, who tested positive, came back, and now is a leading, whatever you want to call it, sportscaster for the Tour, et cetera, and is not really looked on as a bad
guy.
Right? I think that's not because they don't care, but they, even though he lied through his teeth for 2 years, I mean, there's two parts to this mentality. In Europe, there's a belief that you can't win the Tour without something, which,
right,
is total hogwash. If you had, if everybody was clean, somebody's going to win the race.
Yeah,
you know, it's,
yeah,
like you don't need to take drugs to win the Tour de France, and you don't need it to finish a 3-week race. And I believe I'm living proof of it. And I think I had many teammates that I know were absolutely clean. We never had team doctors. I never saw anything. So if the level playing field is there, somebody's going to win a 3-week race. It doesn't matter. It just goes slower. People get tired. The genetically best get better, and they win. But that mentality in Europe is there, and it is part of why there's a problem in cycling, because they are told from a very young age, oh, you can't do the Tour de France in water alone. But saying that, I think that the stomach for what's going on in cycling today has really, it's taken, you know, their stomachs have shrunk a lot.
Yeah.
And they can't really, they're not stomaching it. But I think, like, I believe, you know, what's happening in cycling and sports, I believe that most people who are competing are good people, but it's forcing people to make bad choices. And that doesn't mean, even if Floyd is positive, doesn't make him a bad person, like he's an evil person. He just made a bad choice. And I think there's a level of compassion for people who just say, hey, this is what I did. I respect the athletes that came clean and just say, yeah, I did it.
Right.
And it was wrong. It's a system that I got caught in, and yep. And then you can accept it and forgive him and move on. But when you completely deny it, and I think the only reason Richard Virenque has been, you know, well received is that he finally came clean. I don't think he was well received. Obviously, there's people, just like a lot of athletes, there's people who don't believe that he was taking anything. and there are. There were.
That's amazing.
But we have that in America.
Sure.
There's a lot of people just don't believe an American would take drugs.
Right. Greg, you mentioned earlier about that when you were watching the Tour this year, you saw that Floyd was, 390 watts. You mean 390 watts, sort of averaging that throughout the Tour?
That was 390 watts on the climbs, and that goes back to the historical norm of the Tour de France. There have been recent riders where their wattage is up to 475, 500, which means, you know, power output on cycling is directly correlated to VO2 max and your lactate or your ability to sustain a high power output on a climb or time trial is directly related to your percentage of VO2 max. And the only way to produce real high wattage is with more oxygen. And so if you understand the physiology, you know, even if somebody with, and I know that Floyd had a 90 milliliter, that's what I believe he was tested. I had a 92, 93 milliliter VO2 max. But what you don't realize is that in the 3-week Tour de France, your hematocrit level goes down,
sure,
which means your power output and your VO2 max drops. But up until 1990, there was nobody ever recorded on any climb over 400 watts. All of a sudden, 91 is 420, 430, where to, you know, in the last few years, there's been reportings of 475 to 500 watts, which would mean an athlete to do that at an average weight of, say, 71 kilos, 72, would have to have a VO2 max of 99 milliliters. Very, very high.
Wow.
And so I actually was very encouraged when I watched Floyd, and he was 380, 390. And that's, I publicly said, you know, God, this could be a really clean tour.
Right.
Yeah.
And I was so encouraged by it, and that's why it even hurt more when, you know, this came out. And yeah, I don't know what Floyd's fate will be, and I hope he gets exonerated, but it's going to be very difficult.
Greg, I think this is in all sports, but especially, you know, it's known to be in cycling, and that is the code of silence that I think has only been broken a few times in print. Paul Kimmage touched on it, I think, in a very light way, and Willie Vogt, I think, in a much more deep way. Is Operation Puerto going to be that straw that breaks the camel's back that's going to cause somebody, hopefully, to come out and document the whole thing and say, here is what goes on and here's what happens. And
well,
then, at the same time, will that person get rewarded, even though they
no.
were a cheater, a la Jason Giambi?
With the current, with the past governing body, the people that came, now we keep saying, will somebody come clean? Jesus Manzano, a Spanish rider, came clean. That is where actually the fallout from Jesus Manzano that everybody said was a quack, stupid, liar. It was his confession publicly that led to Operation Puerto. And he listed 30 different products. So it was, people have come clean, but every one of those people get discredited as jealous or whacked out or crazy, or they get dismissed immediately. And there could be, you know, I think that I wish somebody would have the courage to come forward and help the sport. But it's so powerful, you know, you have to admit the guilt and shame to your family, to your friends, and it's a very difficult situation to have people come clean. And then usually if you do, you're probably out of the sport for good.
Well, I was going to say, if you do that, then you're ostracized by the very community that you've worked so hard to become a part of.
That's right. That's the problem. There's no reward for being honest.
Greg,
in any sport right now.
Greg, just so our listeners understand, when somebody is taking a growth hormone of some sort, how much of a difference will that make in terms of, you know, power output for them?
Well, I think it all depends on if it's a one-day race or three-week race. Obviously, in a three-week race, you're having your testosterone, your hormones that help you recover and maintain muscle mass, they're constantly being decreased.
Sure.
And so at the end of a three-week, I've only read, and I do not know this for a fact,
right.
I've read that a growth hormone would be equal to 20 watts. Now,
wow.
At the end of 3 weeks, that's huge.
It's gigantic.
But the big deal is, imagine they showed in the Festina trial, they showed a guy that had a 71 VO2 max, and after 6 months of EPOs, he went to 91.
Whew.
Oh, my God.
Unbelievable.
So,
wow.
You go, okay.
Then you transfer the wattage that person can now push.
That's the big deal. That's what really gives the juice.
So, Betty, you and I could be contenders. You
in
and
a
I
heartbeat.
Let's do it.
That's right. Yeah,
I'm not going to live much longer.
The truth is, you know, obviously the problem is with the idea that it's a level playing field because everybody's doing it. That's not true because not everybody's doing it, and some people aren't willing to do all the experimental stuff. And there's never, the only level playing field is when it's really level.
Right.
There's nothing. Nobody's taking stuff, and I don't know if that'll ever happen. It's a sad option.
Greg, let's say your kids want to become cyclists. What are you going to tell them?
Well, my son is 22. He just became a cyclist. He rebelled against me and never rode. And you mean, I'm just saying he became a cyclist. He loves the sport. He went over and did L'Étape Tour. I'll be honest, my son was in college, started smoking, and quit 6 months ago or 7 months ago, and he got into cycling. He got 387th out of 9,000 riders on the Lap d'Huez stage. And
wow.
Just love cycling.
That's awesome.
Which, this is where I really see the essence of cycling and the participation. My son is just loving it. But he knows what's going on. He would have no desire to turn professional, but he wants to race at a recreational level. He might do some races. And that's where I'd like my kids to find it. I still really enjoy going out riding my bike. It's my preferred way of exercising. But to go into racing, I'm hopeful that this will be the catalyst that really changes the sport. And if it doesn't, then it's going to be a disaster.
Wow.
So I don't know. Right now, if you're 15 or 18, maybe in a couple of years, this is going to be a different sport. And I'm optimistic that will happen. I'm pretty impressed, at least, or encouraged, let's say, by the new president of the UCI and the stance they're taking. And I think that they're taking the right steps.
Greg, I got a question going back to 89. And we all talk about you know, coming from behind and winning the tour, the most exciting tour in history, on the last day by 8 seconds. And the thing that always hits me is there was a time trial earlier in the tour, and you crunched Fignon in that time trial. And he had, 2 weeks to get the bars?
Oh, he trained on those bars.
He
trained on them.
He trained on them afterwards.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
But then he didn't use them on that day.
Oh, yeah, Guimard was publicly stated, they hurt your breathing. They won't be good. And the ironic thing is Fignon was my teammate, and he came on in 82. I was on Renault in 81.
Yeah.
Guimard had access to the wind tunnel in Paris because of Renault and their Formula One Association. And, you know, back in the early 80s with Guimard, we were the first ones to use aero helmets.
Right.
We used Renault and Guimard made the first 4-inch wide rims, flat spokes. We were using those back in 83 and 84.
Wow.
He put on fairings on the back of your seat, which was disallowed by the UCI. So here I show up with this stuff, and Guimard, of all people, should have recognized the benefit, and he decided it wasn't worth it.
Oh,
and
my God.
Even to this day, Fignon, I hear him go, well, he used something that was illegal. Well, it wasn't illegal. It was approved by the UCI, and I had at least the curiosity to try it, and I felt immediately that it was a better option than riding the old way.
And did you not feel that Fignon simply thought he had it? I mean, I think they were predicting that you needed to make the most you could make was 1 second per kilometer, or basically get back like 24 seconds, and
yep,
you had a 50-second deficit. So even with doing the best you could possibly do, you were still going to lose.
Yeah, my thing, and an interesting thing is, a year later, I went and did wind tunnel testing at that same wind tunnel that, in fact, they had wheels that Guimard prepared in from the early 80s at the wind tunnel. And interesting thing with me, and you could take this for what you want, but one thing that Guimard did for both Fignon, Hino, myself, and Charlie Motte, we were all very good time trials because he paid attention to aerodynamics. We all had great aerodynamic positions, and that came from his positioning us on the bike, even before the time trial bars. And when I did the Giro d'Italia that year, the Tour of Italy, in the last time trial, and I wasn't really that great in that race, but I started feeling better. I needed to, you know, each stage I went into the Trevilly, I wasn't pushing myself, and I decided I need to really push myself just to have confidence where I stand. So it was a 50-kilometer time trial, and I beat Fignon by a minute and 21 seconds with the same equipment that he was using, no aero bars or anything. And when I was calculating the advantage I had per kilometer per second with the same equipment, I decided I was going to be very close. I figured I'd be around 40 to 45 seconds. And but I was riding. That was with the difference between a Trevilly, and I felt significantly better. So I actually thought, given that I didn't know anything about the time advantage those bars would give,
right,
I just tried them and I liked them and I used them. And but a year later, I went back. We did the wind tunnel test, and the bars made up. Obviously, this was a very fast course. I think I might have set the record. I think if you're doing the record today, I would be 2 kilometers slower because it was started in Versailles. There was a couple kilometers of downhill and very fast course. But we calculated I needed about 400 plus watts, 420 watts, if it was dead flat. But the aero bars made up around 8 seconds.
Wow!
And that's what we calculated from my old position to my new position, because I still remember USA Today, they said, well, those bars were 2 seconds a kilometer. The helmet was 3 seconds a kilometer. I'm thinking, God, I didn't even have to pedal. I mean, I just won the race without pedaling. But the interesting, the Giro helmet that I used, yeah, in the way, because we did an actual active aerodynamic test where I was pedaling and I would get in the effort that I was racing in. And I had a really nervous way of riding a time trial. I always put my head down or lifted my head up. I never had just a steady head.
Right, right.
And that's how that helmet was, the only way that thing ever came out in the studies that was halfway fast was head on, straight on, no dipping down. The helmet we calculated, and I still have the studies here, was about a 12-second drag.
Oh, because you were looking down too much.
Yeah, I was looking. Either I looked down, the tail was dragging
sticking
air,
up, yeah,
or I looked up, it was a parachute.
That is funny.
It was no in between. So, but I do believe those bars absolutely made a difference, especially in the first big time trial.
Oh, yeah,
yeah.
You know, and it just, you know, I feel bad for Fignon, but at the time, that was part. Equipment's part of cycling. Disc wheels, it's that calculation. What do I use in this climb? Do I use the lightest? Do I use the strongest? That's part of it. It's kind of like Formula One racing. It's part of the game. And Fignon calculated wrong, and fortunately for me, I won the Tour.
You know, speaking of equipment, one of the things that really, I think, was impressed upon me and a lot of people at that time was the fact that you did not want a speedometer, you did not want a watch, you didn't want to hear time splits, you didn't want to hear anything. Do you think today there is too much reliance among athletes,
especially the Tour,
for heart rate monitors,
oh,
and GPS and average speed and time gaps and all that stuff, as opposed to just simply focusing?
Yeah, well, you know, the interesting, I was, what's hard, what people don't understand, you know, wattage is one thing. If they've trained enough with watts, they could actually do a time trial very close to what their max would be if they're really in tune with it. But with heart rate, you have what they call heart rate drift. And I still remember in 89, I did an uphill time trial where I felt fairly good, but my max heart rate I thought was 190, and I thought my supposed lactate threshold, this was back in the 80s science, was around 180. So I do this uphill time trial, and I'm always around, my heart rate's just creeping up to 185, and I keep backing it off to keep it at 180, keep 180. And I get done with the time trial, I'm like, God, I didn't even push myself. And I'm 19th out of... You know, I could have easily gone 2 minutes faster had I just pushed myself. But I kept thinking, and only then after I learned about heart rate drift and the thermal energy that you're producing, you could have the same wattage, but your heart rate, with it's warm, you what you might, at your, say, your sustainable speed at, like, say, lactate threshold, if it's cold out, you might be doing 175 heartbeats. But if it's 25, 30 degrees warmer, that same output, instead of 175, will give you 185, because your heart rate's trying to, in sweating, you're trying to cool yourself down. So I never used heart rate monitors in race. I did use the SRM my last 2 years of racing, which really educated me on the type of training cyclists need, much more intervals, much more undulating accelerations. But it also was, you know, with SRM, which is a power meter, I was able to retest my lactate threshold, my sustainable threshold, on a weekly basis based upon my perceived effort, my heart rate relative to power output. And you could see if you were accumulating too much lactic acid within 5 minutes, your power output would start to descend and your heart rate would go up. So I still train today with an SRM. My son has an SRM. I think it's kind of it's the best way to manage your recovery. If you're fully recovered, you should be able to do an interval or a sprint or an effort that you did the week before or surpass that. If you're not, it'll indicate that you're tired, you need more rest. But as far as, like, the radios, I never liked to hear any splits because it didn't make a difference. I was basically going to dose myself at 100% whichever way it went. And I guess I've acknowledged that I have real bad ADD. And truly, like, if I had my coach yelling at me, I've actually turned around and put my finger, my index finger, over my lips, like, shh, be quiet.
So
in a time trial, it breaks my focus.
Right.
And I just wanted to focus on my effort. And some people thrive on that yelling and go, 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 and they get motivated. For me, it was a total distraction. And as far as the radios for tactics, I don't believe you should have them at all in a race, because it's really, it takes the athletic in the tactical sense out of the rider and leaves it in the hand of the director. And I used the radio in the very, when it first came out, and the benefit I never thought of, at the time there was no TV that was being transmitted to the team. And so it really, the point of the radio was to, if you had a flat, to get an immediate, and that I liked, to get immediate mechanical help, or if you were out of water bottles, you can get that up. But I don't like the idea that they're using it for tactics. It takes away the bluffing. I'm certain if Fignon would have had a radio and Guimard had a radio in 1989 on L'Alpe d'Huez, I would not have won the Tour de France. There's a great story, because Guimard was my coach. He knew that I was getting tired, and my shoulder was starting to rock. And he came up to Fignon, and my team director was in front of him, and they literally banged cars and crashed each other, and my coach wouldn't let him come up because he knew I was, both coaches knew I was really hurting. Guimard came up to Fignon and said, attack, and Fignon looked, he says, I can't. So Guimard goes back, he waits another kilometer or two, and he really sees I'm really hurting, and Guimard tries coming back, and they literally are just banging cars. Guimard comes up to the front and says, you have to attack now. And he attacks, he drops me, and takes a minute and a half out of me. Had he done it 2 kilometers before, I would have been cooked.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, obviously I'm biased because I'm glad I won the Tour de France, but the reality is, at the same time, in that same Tour de France, I know that Fignon in the Tour Malais was getting dropped. And I have to laugh because he always says he would have won the race, and Andy Hampson was a witness to it, but on the Tour Malais, it was the first climb up to, I think, Super Bagnère, and it was a very fast pace over Tour Malais, and Fignon was getting dropped, and he actually held onto a motorcycle. And at the end of the stage, he criticized me for not being the leader, wearing the yellow jersey, and I should have paced, and I literally had no teammates.
Right.
And I went up to him the next morning. I said, Laurent, you better be quiet about that. I watched you yesterday. You held onto a motorcycle. You were getting dropped. And in that time at the Tour de France, if you ever even touched a motorcycle like that and held on, you were immediately disqualified.
Wow.
So, had I known at that time that Fignon was getting dropped with the radio, I would have tried to accelerate and drop him. So it
bounced out.
It all balances out, yeah. And I think that having no radios is, from a tactical point of view, much more interesting.
Actually, another Finney story that goes along with the radios. Remember, Huddle? They were down in Mexico, the same race, and Kiefel and Finney are pacing you, supposedly. And they're going and going and going, and all of a sudden Finney goes, hey, Ron, you seen Greg? Have you seen Greg? He goes, no. Well, why don't you drop back a little bit? Maybe he's back in the pack. He drops back. He says, comes back, goes, I don't know where he is. And then this truck comes by with you in the back of the truck screaming.
You're right.
You had flatted like early on, and you're like wearing a cowboy hat or something, and you're in the back of the truck.
Well, what happened is I was in leader's jersey, and you're right. Kiefel and Finney were pacing the race, and I flatted, and the team truck forgot to put fuel in the truck. So while they stopped for 20 minutes to get fuel and drinks, I'm sitting by the roadside for 15 or 20 minutes, so I'm 20 minutes behind the group. And I grab onto the truck. I decide I'm out of the race anyway, so I grab onto the truck, and I'm going 60 miles an hour with my left arm holding on to the truck.
Oh, so you're on your bike.
I'm on my bike, 60 miles an hour, trying to catch up. And I get within about a mile of the peloton, and the official's hiding in the bushes, waiting for me. So he comes out, he goes immediately, you're disqualified, 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And I go, disqualified? I quit. And I jumped in the back of the pickup, and I drove by and I waved to everybody. I ended up going body surfing that week, that afternoon on the beach, and
I love that.
I was really bummed out. I actually, it was such a fun race, and it was about a 9-day stage race, and we were winning races, and I was going to win the overall, and for that to happen, Finney's got a great memory. I don't remember all that stuff.
Oh, he was hysterical. He just said he said it was so funny because they're like going so hard, and all of a sudden, like, wait, where's Greg?
Where's this guy? We're supposed to be pacing.
Where's the guy we're pulling? Where'd he go?
I remember that stage like it was yesterday. I mean, I can remember the whole layout of the stage.
That's so funny. Hey, Greg, thanks so much for taking so much time.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You know, anytime someone is a three-time winner of the Tour de France and world champion and won the Worlds and the Tour in the same year in 89 and Sportsman of the Year, any opinions that you have on your sport, you are more than welcome to be giving.
They're sometimes not too popular.
You know what? People need to know. They need to know your opinions.
They need to hear it.
You love the sport. You always have. And
that's right.
And the fact
that
you love the sport, you're doing it. You're coming from a place of, I want to see the sport still here and still vibrant 50 years from now.
That's right.
And having it go into the crapper doesn't help any of us.
Well, thank you guys. I mean, you guys are on that southern. San Diego area. That's, I love riding there. And
we'll
maybe I'll
back.
See you guys out there.
Love it. Hey, Greg Lamont, thank you so much.
Thanks, Greg.
Bye, Paul. Bye, Bob.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Greg Lamont, Huddle.
Yo.
What do you think?
I thought that was incredible. I thought, you know, it's like we've been watching it for quite a while and listening to people say it's sour grapes.
Right.
And like I said, I mean, you and I have both met Greg, and I don't know that that's necessarily the case. I think he's honest about it.
He loves his sport. And
like
you said, and if you listen to that soundbite that we had with Greg from back, I mean, that's like 97, 98.
Yeah.
He was saying the same thing back then. It's not like he was waiting for, oh, gosh, Lance now has won as many tours as I have, and I'm bitter.
Right. But that's when he really got labeled as, you know, being sour about the whole thing,
right,
simply because it was another American, and that really wasn't the case. I think the best thing he said was just looking at the stats. And when you look at some of the literature that's been written about doping, especially with regard to track and field and not just the running events, but the weight events, the times when the records are being set and when the distances are going a lot further and when the times are coming down, you can correlate those with the drugs that have come into that sport. And he's saying the same thing about the average speeds and the power output. And not to say that, you know, human beings are not going to improve and get faster and be able to throw farther, but he's just saying not at that percentage, not in that amount of time.
Well, and also here's a guy who's just coming off of winning the Tour de France.
Yeah.
In 89 and 90, 2 years in a row.
Right, 91.
And in his training for 91, like he said, he was going faster.
Yeah.
He was in better shape.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, people, you know, the wattage is going up and people are riding away from him who've never been competitive with him before.
Right, right.
That's a weird one.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Interesting.
We are brought to you every Sunday night by Rubio's Jamba Juice, CompetitorRadio.com, MuddyBuddy.com. Tell your buddies about CompetitorRadio.com. You can check out the Greg Lamont interview and other great interviews with Lance Armstrong and Mark Ziegler if you want to know more about the world of drugs.
Bob Roll.
Bob Roll.
Peter Reed.
Hold on. We'll be right back.